Fresno. And at this particular point, we would most certainly like to welcome you into Cover to Cover. Today, an interview with Eric Alterman, author of What Liberal Media? The Truth About Bias and the News. Today's Cover to Cover is hosted by Richard Walensky. And please stay tuned now for this interview with Eric Alterman.
Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Eric Alterman, who's got a book, What Liberal Media? The Truth About Bias and the News. Eric Alterman is a columnist, media columnist for The Nation magazine. First of all, when we're talking media here, we're talking news and analysis. We're not talking cultural media. We're not talking television, any material.
Right. The right wing is all over me on that point. They say, even if you're right about everything, what about Hollywood? And I say, well, it's another story we can talk about. I didn't write that book. You know,
right.
We're a different book. But you're also right to, and I always try and make this point early, it's the media are. And the media are a very complicated set of organisms that don't form a single animal or a single beast. Charlie Rose is not in the same business as Rush Limbaugh. The New York Times is not in the same business as the National Enquirer. And to refer to both of them as, quote-unquote, the media is to end up saying nothing. Marshall McLuhan was not really right when he said the medium is the message. The medium is one of the messages.
Let's talk about the two areas we do know about. One is called analysis, which these days is mostly right-wing ranting and raving. And the other is the news and news reportage itself.
Mm-hmm.
I think most of us, probably even people on the right, will acknowledge that the so-called analysis, a large percent of it is right-wing ranting and raving.
Yeah, they don't call it ranting and raving, but I don't get much argument when I talk about the punditocracy. That there's no question that, you know, in radio, talk radio, it's just as bad for liberals as it was for conservatives in Stalin's Soviet Union. I mean, there's less ideological variety there than there is in a totalitarian society. And television, on cable TV, it's almost as bad, not quite as bad. On broadcast TV, it's bad. There aren't any liberals on broadcast TV giving their opinions. There are a few conservatives. There are a bunch of centrists who tend to lean conservative. In print, it's pretty close to even. It's closer to even. It's actually dominated by centrists who lean conservative. There are a lot of conservatives. What I think is interesting about print is that all of the conservatives are on TV. And none of the liberals are. I mean, there are a lot of good liberals. We just lost Frank Rich. But Frank Rich and Paul Krugman and Rick Hertzberg and Richard Cohen, I think they're all very good. But none of them are on TV.
Eric Alterman, when we're talking about the news itself, when we're moving away from those few columnists, it strikes me as I read the news, and this is not just from the Times or the San Francisco Chronicle, it strikes me that we're not getting the news coverage today that we got 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And people I know, and this includes people like Frank Viviano, who's the foreign correspondent for the Chronicle, will say that, in fact, if you really want to get the news, international news, you have to get out of the country and go online and find papers like Le Monde.
I don't think I agree with that entirely. I actually think the New York Times has gotten really good in the past few years. And I think the Washington Post has gotten worse. The New York Times has gotten good. I also think the Wall Street Journal is a great newspaper if you don't read the editorial pages. I do think that actually, I don't disagree that Le Monde is better. And I don't disagree that The Guardian is in some ways better, although they don't have anything like the resources that Le Monde and The Times do. But I think that's a little bit unfair. I think The Times has made a commitment to international coverage at a time when everybody else has cut back to next to nothing. Two things have happened in the media, by and large, that you need to understand. One is there's been an enormous pressure on profits from the corporate owners. And that's, I hate to sound like a shill for The Times, because most of the time I read it and I get furious at it. But the New York Times is increasingly valuable in a time when everybody else is owned by people who don't give a damn about journalism. The Times gives a damn about journalism. It makes a lot of mistakes. It's biased in a lot of ways. But they're honest mistakes and honest bias, and I've come to appreciate it more. That's one thing. So people are closing foreign bureaus. They're increasingly relying on wire services, and they just don't have the resources to do the news that they want to do anymore. On the other hand, also for economic reasons, there's been an increasing rush towards tabloidization. So I was supposed to be on MSNBC to talk about France today, this morning, but instead I was kicked off because of developments in, some tabloid story. I don't even know. I never even quite heard of it. I try to ignore the tabloid stories. The networks, they can't fight this. There's less and less news in the news, and there's more and more. It's more and more of the same. I was, I spent 2 years being a pundit at MSNBC when it first began, and because of this intense rush for ratings, this was during the Monica Lewinsky period. They would go on the air with stuff that they hadn't reported, and they had no idea whether or not it was true, but it was too good to let go, and they didn't like doing that. They weren't proud of themselves for doing that. Journalists are not pleased with themselves for reporting on missing children all the time, when in fact the number of missing children is going down. But there's this, Andy Lack, the president of NBC News, he used to pick the topic that we would discuss on MSNBC, which nobody was watching. There was fewer than 100,000 people watching at any one time in those days. And yet it was important enough to Andy Lack to pick the topic that we would discuss for 15 minutes because he was so afraid of people and their clickers. So I think if you ask people in journalism, even though they don't care about the ideological analysis of my book, they would agree that the pressure, the corporate pressure for profits and for ratings is making their life impossible to be honest journalists, and it's pushing them in directions they would prefer not to go. And on top of that, you have this intense, powerful right-wing movement pressuring them every time they hear something they don't like, and nothing remotely similar on the left. So they can get away with saying anything they want, slandering the left, if they want to, if they happen to be that kind of person, or if they're just lazy. But you can't get away with slandering the right, because you generate an enormous amount of mail, you generate an enormous amount of phone calls and email, and you don't do it the next time, because who needs that headache?
And on top of that, certain tropes, which may or may not be true, but are usually not true, such as the way that they trashed David Brock for his book based upon something that was actually incorrect, or the way they trashed Gore, as you go into your book, What Liberal Media, Eric Alterman, the three stories of Gore, the Love Canal story, yeah, the love story, and the Internet story, these things turn out not to be true. They slam them anyway. And they slammed Michael Moore for one error in his book, which concerned whether the bin Ladens actually were flown out of the country before planes were, other planes were in the air.
I think they were, though. Weren't they? That turns out not to be true?
I have been told that one is not true.
Oh, I have the impression that was true. That the bin Ladens were able to leave the country on September 11th or 12th and nobody else were. But maybe it's been disproved and I didn't hear about it.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe the disproof is false.
Hitchens wrote it up in The Nation about a year later, and I mentioned it on Bill Moyer's show, and I think it's true.
Then if that's the case, then it's another lying trope that, that gets... So we can assume that that your book will find its way into the same kind of trash heap.
Well, there are mistakes in the book. I don't think there... I mean, there are errors in the book. It was rushed to press a little too quickly for my taste, and that turns out to have been a mistake because of typos in it and a couple of errors I might have found. I've only found, actually, I think, three errors of fact. They're all very minor. They're sort of, I meant 1964 and I wrote 1952 or something. There are no errors that I've found that are sort of ideological misrepresentations. And I don't go after anybody for their mistakes in the book. I go after people for what appear to be, to me, to be deliberate perversions of what liberals or someone else is trying to say. So I'm very proud of it in that regard, because I really tried hard not to take any cheap shots. You know, I don't know if I believe David Brock, okay? I generally tend to believe him, but I can't be sure. So whenever I quote David Brock, I say, well, there's a possibility that he's not telling the truth, because he spent a long time in his life not telling the truth. And when you have somebody like that, you have to be careful. I don't take as gospel anything that I don't think has been well proven. And I think that in the reaction to my book, I don't want to whine about myself, but you're absolutely right that there is this incredibly effective and powerful machine out there on the right that, when they find something, when they find any point of weakness, and in any book there's going to be points of weakness. And in fact, in the preface to my book, I say, I'm sure there are errors in this book, and they're all my parents' fault. But because the right has this incredibly effective machine with hundreds and hundreds of organizations and its own media machine, you know, with Fox News and Wall Street Journal editorial page and Washington Times and New York Post, and it's got tabloids, it's got high, it can go low, it can go radio with Rush Limbaugh, yeah, you're going to get bashed, and you're never going to catch up with it, and you just got to live with that. That's part of what I get paid for, and I hope I get paid well enough.
Eric Alterman, a couple of things that I've noticed that are not particularly mentioned in your book. One is, it seems to me that when I watch the right-wing pundits go after something, like, for instance, the day after the November 2002 election, you turn to different stations, and I heard Trent Lott talking about what the Democrats needed to do, which is move to the center, otherwise they become the minority party or some kind of crap like that. And then I heard Tucker Carlson use the exact same words on a different station. Is there some kind of talking points email or website that they all go to?
Well, there's a blast fax from the Republican Party.
Oh, there is?
Yeah, sure. There's also one from the Democratic Party, but the Republicans stick to their talking points and Democrats don't. That's sort of all you need to know about the two parties right there. That, in fact, Republicans have a lot more money. But there are blast fax, there are talking points. The pundits get to them. During that period, they were incredibly disciplined in sticking to them. Democrats never stick to anything.
The other point, which I've made a few times, and I remember I made it to Jeff Greenfield, and he looked at me like I was nuts. And when I made the same point to Molly Ivan, she said, "Of course," which is that the Republicans early on, and now we can go back to the Reagan era, began realizing that if they change the words being used, the vocabulary, they gain a certain edge. So, for instance, welfare becomes an entitlement program instead. And it seems to me that if you begin charting, you begin seeing how right-wing terms replaced other terms down the line. Is this something you've seen?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. They understand the power of language. You know, 70% of the people, the most interesting thing is happening right now. We've just experienced the most intense propaganda effort on behalf of this war that I've ever seen in my life. When the propaganda effort began, 27% of the country was willing to go invade Iraq without the permission of the United Nations. After it was over, 38% was willing. Not a very big jump, given how hard they pushed. But if you look at another poll, you'll find that 70% of the American people believed that Saddam Hussein was somehow responsible for 9/11. So even though they have this misinformation that's been drilled into their heads that there's no support for anywhere, and the CIA denies it, they still believe it. But my point is that even though everyone who pays careful attention to the issue knows that Bush has been unable to prove this point, he's still got 70% of the country with him, and that's because pundits like William Safire and the Wall Street Journal have been, William Crystal to some degree, not as bad as Safire, have been so effective at beating this issue without any care whatsoever for normal standards of evidence.
You're listening to Eric Alterman, whose latest book is What Liberal Media. Eric Alterman, it seems to me that when we look at these pundits and this propaganda machine, which seems to be coming from the center right, and the far right, it seems that some of it seems to be emanating from this bizarre beltway world. Molly Ivins once said that when she spent about 6 weeks there, she got caught up in it. How strong is that, and how do you think that affects what the rest of us see and hear?
Well, I lived in Washington for 8 or 10 years, and I was working for Mother Jones and The Nation and Rolling Stone, so I was never really... Molly worked for The New York Times, so she was sort of more desirable company than I was. You can't help but get caught up in it to some degree because that's where you live. You know, and it's a big problem. My first book is kind of about this problem, the punditocracy. To me, the most interesting debate about democracy that's ever taken place, perhaps since the Federalist Papers, is the one between Lippmann and Dewey in 1927 about what is democracy. Lippmann says democracy is impossible because people don't have good enough information to make good decisions, and we should really just forget about it and let the people with good information make the best decisions for us. And Dewey said, well, that doesn't really work because those people end up having different interests than the people who they're deciding for. And that Dewey always makes this example, says you can be the best shoemaker in the world, but only the guy wearing the shoes can tell you where it hurts. So democracy is about watchdogness. And even if you don't have, even if people don't have good information, they have the right to make their own mistakes. Now, if you believe that democracy, if you think Dewey won that argument, that democracy is possible, even though it's decidedly imperfect, and most Democrats do, then you have it. Then you have the problem that he laid out and never solved, which is if you send people to Washington to be your watchdog, how do you expect them to stay loyal to your values rather than the values of the people around them? So it's not evil or insidious. It's just the way it is. If you go to Washington and live there, your friends live there too. The people whose opinions you care about live there. The people who you need to do your job effectively live there, your sources. You write for the people you know and admire. You don't write for the people who sent you there anymore. And so you end up being captured. I mean, I'm sure this happens if people have gone to college. The same thing happens to you. You're no longer trying to impress your high school friends or your parents. You're trying to impress the people in your dorm room. You want them to like you and admire you and sit with you at dinner and invite you to their party. So Washington's exactly the same way, except worse. It's not even like college. It's more like high school. So that's an impossible problem to solve. I don't know how you solve that problem. But you should recognize it and understand that people in Washington are writing for other people in Washington, not for you.
One other aspect which gets thrown into the mix as well, which you discuss in What Liberal Media, but I don't think there's enough emphasis on it, is the conflict of interest that occurs involving columnists and who pays them.
Yeah, I've written about that a lot in the past. Jim Fallows wrote a lot about that in his very good book about journalism. Breaking News, I think that's called. Yeah, Cokie Roberts and Steve Roberts get paid $40,000 to give a talk by, like, the American Medical. I don't know who they actually accepted a fee from William Morris, a tobacco firm. And then I think the story I tell in the book is that Cokie called in sick that day, and William and Steve went by himself. And I imagine they got paid anyway, although I don't know that for sure. But, yeah, most news organizations have a policy that says that journalists can't speak to or receive fees from anyone who hasn't whose issues they cover. But all of these big corporations have issues before Congress, and the definition that journalists use is usually very narrow. And it's even worse than that, because it's just important what you don't write is what you write. So if you decide not to cover an issue because you might get a speaking fee from those people. And you can't help it, because the speaking fees are, it's the easiest money in the world. I mean, I've gotten a few of them. My speaking fees are not that high compared to these guys. But, you know, to not write, if you're going to write something that could cost you $25,000, I mean, you don't really have much interest in writing that. And it's $25,000 for 2 hours' work. It's hard to turn down, and it's hard to, you know, and once you get used to it, everybody knows once your standard of living improves, you get attached to that standard of living. So once you get used to it, you get addicted to it. So, yeah, it's a big problem, and the media organizations are penny-wise and pound-foolish about enforcing it. I mean, the most egregious example is actually not the money. In my opinion, it's not the money from corporations. It's this role that Howard Kurtz plays by being the media critic for both CNN and The Washington Post. And I've actually talked to Len Downey Jr., the executive editor of The Post, about this, and he says, look, being a media critic is itself a conflict of interest. If Howie Kurtz writes about the New York Times, it's a conflict of interest, because we're the Washington Post. So all we can do is inform people that he works for CNN when he writes about CNN. Now, this isn't enough. I mean, even if Downey's right, and he is kind of right, you can still do everything you can to minimize the conflict of interest. And for instance, when Howie Kurtz covered Walter Isaacson stepping down at CNN recently, I wrote this in The Nation. This didn't make it into the book. He was very tough on Isaacson, which is fine. I think journalists should be tough on executives. But he didn't mention in that article that his time for reliable sources on CNN had just been cut in half that week, presumably by Walter Isaacson. I mean, Isaacson was in charge. He signed off on the deal if he didn't actually make the decision. And now the only reason I know this, to be fair to Kurtz, is he did say so on an online chat. But who reads online chats except people like me who do it for a living, and, you know, a few people who are obsessed by the issue. It's to me astonishing that neither the Washington Post nor CNN can spend enough money on their media critic to say, you're only going to work for us and you're not going to work for anybody else, and that way your one conflict will be clear to everybody. New York Magazine employs a terrific media critic named Michael Wolff, who they pay a fortune to, and he doesn't do anything but write that one column every week, and it's a great column, and it's fearless, and it's, to me, what media criticism should be. Now, on the other hand, I'm kind of attacking myself here, because I work for both The Nation and MSNBC. But the difference between me and Howie Kurtz is that I choose what I write about, and I can ignore anything. And I do ignore a lot of things that would be uncomfortable for me to write about. I'm nicer to my friends than I am to other people. I can't help it. And I admit that.
Eric Alterman, you talk to a number of these right-wing pundits, and I, from having read David Brock's book, and again, we have to put questions there, he claims that he really hadn't no politics, and he claims that, in fact, Ann Coulter may have no politics either. Did the rest of these people, and I know people who've spoken with Limbaugh in his early days, when he didn't believe what he was saying, do you think all these right-wing pundits actually believe what they're saying? Or are they just taking the money and running with it? And
Well, I think if they didn't believe what they were saying, they end up believing what they're saying. I think you come to believe what you're saying, whether you start out or not. I was present at the creation of Ann Coulter when we were both hired at MSNBC when nobody had ever heard of her. And she was just the looniest, craziest person I had ever met. I couldn't believe what I was hearing from day one. So I think she believes it.
Was that off the air as well as on?
Yeah. She's out of her mind. I mean, it was kind of close between her and Laura Ingraham for a while. They hired the thing they wanted at MSNBC was really nutty. They wanted black and blonde conservatives. I used to joke that if I heard that Quincy Jones married Peggy Lipton from the Mod Squad and they had a daughter, and I thought that if she turned out to be a conservative, they would give her a lifetime contract because they'd have a black blonde conservative. But they had three blonde chicks who were all very right wing. They were sort of counter programming. Laura Ingraham, Ann Coulter, and a woman named Jennifer Grossman. And Ann was the nuttiest. I was there the day that Ann said to a legless Vietnam veteran, "You're the reason we lost the war." And she said worse things. I mean, she was there when they were running film of Pamela Harriman's funeral, and she called her a whore who slept her way to the top at the woman's funeral on the air. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's incredibly insulting to the American public that that we know Ann Coulter's name, because clearly her talents do not lie in analysis. They lie in her ability to say the most outrageous things imaginable and to have really good legs and really blonde hair. And you know, people wrote to me. I referred to her bony ass in The Nation once, and a lot of people wrote to me that was incredibly sexist. But the whole point of Ann Coulter is her body and her looks. And if you can't talk about that, you're giving away the game. And it's a joke to pretend that Ann Coulter and Laura Ingraham and people like that are not there for their looks. To be fair, Brokaw and Jennings are very good-looking, too, and they wouldn't be there if they weren't so good-looking in their own way. But I think they have more to offer in their careers than Coulter and Ingraham.
Brock once said of Ingraham that he walked into her house and saw not a book in the house, which I think is indicative. But that brings up something else, which is the fact that these folks talk and talk and talk and sound as if they know what they're talking about, but the level of education is not there.
Yeah. Well, there's not much value. In fact, I quote Margaret Carlson in the book saying, "I'm a perfect pundit because I don't know much about anything, and therefore I can say anything I want. I don't have to worry about everything being more complicated than that." And, you know, I just got my doctorate a few weeks ago from Stanford in American history. And I got to tell you, it's probably a net negative in terms of working in TV than it is a plus. It's not like something I would put on my resume if I ever wanted to be hired as a pundit again.
Last Sunday, I was turning around the dials in preparation for this interview to see what was what during the Sunday talk shows. And I noticed a couple of things. First was, out of the 15 or so people I saw talking, the only one who might have even been anti-war was one Democratic operative, a woman. And the other thing is that they had on the editor for New Republic, who looked to be about 12 years old. At one point,
Peter Beinart.
Yeah. At one point, he said he was in Europe, where they're far more anti-war than here, and he thinks the reason they are is because the people in Europe never suffered the trauma of 9/11, like the people in America. And I'm thinking, does this guy know history? Nobody questioned it.
Look, I mean, you can say anything you want on pundit television, and nobody's going to question you, in part because it's impolite. When I did it, I used to get in so much trouble. I would say, I mean, I'd go on MSNBC, and Laura or Ann would say something, and I would say, "Defend your statement. What's your evidence?" And it was the most hostile, ridiculous thing, and they'd be yelling it in my ears, "Stop that, Eric. You're being obnoxious." I was on Ron Owen the other day, and he kept saying, "So, Eric, you say this." And I would say, "No, Ron, I didn't say that. I said this." And he thought this was incredibly obnoxious, to insist on the accuracy of my own statements and not defend statements he wanted to put in my mouth. There's just no emphasis no value, no intrinsic instrumentality whatsoever to accuracy or even making sense on television, as long as it sounds okay. And what Peter Barnard said sounds true if you don't think about it that hard. And that's what a good pundit does. That's why it's such a shame that so much of our discourse is on TV, because it's worthless for discourse.
Eric Alterman, here we are. We're talking about this. It's nice that you have a book with all of this material and gives us a few talking points here and there. I think the best thing to do is mostly just turn this stuff off and get our news and information from sources that are less shrill.
I disagree with that, by the way. I think
the
best thing to do is to read it very carefully with a very critical eye, but there's a lot of information. Most of the data in this book comes from mainstream sources. That's where the resources are. I mean, it takes a lot of work, and if you don't have the time for it, you might not want to do it. But I think that most things worth knowing you can find in the mainstream media. It's just an awful lot of work to find them.
Then what can people do about it? How do you deal with, okay, we could subscribe to The Nation.
Yeah.
I mean, get other information. But is there anything anybody can do to help move things in a better direction? Just the person on the street, anybody?
Well, everybody asks me this when I give talks, and the answer is always the same. The media, like the political system, is a reflection of the political forces in this country. It's partially a reflection of money, and it's partially a reflection of political forces. And the political forces on the right are just a lot better organized, more efficient, more mature than political forces on the left. They work together, they cooperate, they compromise. The Christian Coalition didn't start a splinter party designed to destroy the guys that almost agree with them on everything. They took over part of the Republican Party. They don't fight about it. The Christian Coalition sent out, I always tell the story, they sent out something like 6 million, maybe it's a million, I don't know, millions of copies of the Contract of America in 1994. Contract of America had nothing to do with any Christian Coalition issues. They just knew that they'd be better off with their guy in power. They wanted to fight once they got into power, not out of power, because they were going to get something for their fight. Liberals fight without getting into power. It's inconceivable that any liberal organization would have put out a mass mailing that didn't address their issues. It's actually inconceivable that they would put one out that didn't address their issues in the order they wanted them addressed. I think that's the biggest problem. I think the country's more liberal than Democrats. But liberals are, on the one hand, people are alienated. On the other hand, the leadership of the movement is just not strategic. It's not mature. It hasn't lost for long enough that it hates it enough to want to win. Noam Chomsky's not on the ballot, and if he were on the ballot, he wouldn't win. So you got to pick between the two guys that are going to win. It's not about therapy. It's about who's going to be running the country.
This is the Eric Alterman approach. Always go for the lesser of two evils if it comes down to that.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't go for Mussolini over Hitler, but yeah, just about always.
You've been listening to an interview with Eric Alterman, whose book, What Liberal Media? The Truth About Bias in the News, is actually, at this point, I think, required reading. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.
And you've been listening to Cover to Cover on KPFA or KPFB, Berkeley or KFCF, Fresno. Today's interview was produced by Richard Walensky. Listen to Thursday Cover to Cover shows on our website, www.bookwaves.com, in streaming audio. Please write us at bookwaves@hotmail.com or call KPFA at 848-6767, extension 630. Next Thursday, Richard Walensky interviews Luis Erdrich, author of the novel The Master Butcher's Singing. Please stay tuned now for the special 3-hour National Forum on Peace. In the first hour, Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! In New York, and also KPFK News Director M.T. Karthik from Los Angeles. The focus will be on privatization of resources in Iraq, profiteering, the global peace movement, what next, and also regional gatherings coming up. Please stay tuned in about a minute. This is a 3-hour broadcast featuring a whole host of other people, including Robert Knight and Dennis Bernstein, Verna Avery Brown, and Larry Bensky. That's coming up in about 50 seconds.
Celebrate the Earth at the 4th annual Fresno Earth Day Festival, Sunday, April 27th, from noon to sundown. The day will include local and national bands, speakers, dancers, and drummers performing on a solar-powered stage, bringing flavors from around the world to Fresno's downtown Courthouse Park. Weave your way through environmental exhibits,